So I'm a brother. I think I've told you this before. I'm a brother, and growing up, I actually shared a bed with my younger brother for quite a while. And when you are sharing a bed with a brother, you have to be very particular about space. So we developed this system, and I don't know if it was me, it was my older brother who passed it on to me. We developed this system called pass the line, pay the fine. Which means if he ever rolled onto my half of the bed, he had to pay the fine. The fine usually took the form of a swift hammer fist on whatever body part had crossed the line. And this, we took this to our, on our road trips also. So whenever we would be crammed three across in a van seat, if anybody ever passed outside of their seat, it was a quick pass the line, pay the fine. My parents, I'm sure, hated us for it, but still, this is brothers, this is what we do. It was probably one of the nicest things we did to each other. So, but what I find very striking about that is something I think we can all relate to. I felt that because my brothers had done this infraction towards me, they had invaded my personal space, I felt that I had the right to strike back, to take retaliation, to exact justice for crossing into my airspace. Now it's starting to sound a little too political, isn't it? But it's true. There was this innate sense in me as a child that you wronged me, so I get to wrong you back. Do you guys know the difference between retaliation and retribution? These are words that we might use them, but they have some very important nuances. Retribution is when somebody on the outside of a conflict imposes justice in some way. So you go to courts to get retribution for whatever wrong has been committed. Retaliation is when, it's mostly military, but if we use it interpersonally, it's when I try to exact my justice from you without a third party who's mediating it and doing it. So when my brother crosses the line and I smack him for it, that's retaliation. When my mom turns around and says, Jamie, don't hit your brother, that's retribution. See the difference? Do you guys see this similar idea of retaliation around you? In your lives, maybe it was just us brothers on this trip, but it can be innocuous, like pass the line, pay the fine, or simply prank wars that kind of are just fun back and forth. It could be civil disagreements where you need to go to court to have this settled. It could be road rage incidents. Isn't it crazy to think that there are people who die from road rage incidents? Because for some reason, that driver thinks that they have the right to attack the other person for whatever happened. This innate desire, flaw in us, it's everywhere. We think we have the right to strike back. And maybe you're thinking, I'm civilized. I don't hit people. But I want to ask you, do you retaliate emotionally towards people? Do you retaliate socially towards people? When somebody wrongs you, do you then try to isolate them from the community, from your life? I think, sadly, this probably happens a lot in our marriages and in our really special relationships. Our retaliation is not often upfront and physical, but it's more avoidance, ignoring, silent treatment. Silent treatment is probably the best example of this kind of retaliation. And we might not even know that that's what we're doing, but we're trying to take vengeance on them for some wrong they did to us. And it plays out in a lot of different ways throughout the rest of our lives. But one key concept to retaliation is that it always escalates, doesn't it? My brother waved his hand over my air, so I smacked it, and then he probably hit me back, and next thing you know, it's WWE in our van driving down to Vancouver. Because it always escalates. We never just want to get even. We need to have one more above. So think about your own examples of when you do have this desire to retaliate. You usually want to hurt the person more than they hurt you, don't you? I don't think I'm alone in having that desire. I think in Canada we often try to find civil ways to do this, but this desire is still present. So I want to start with that just to get us on a real down low note so I can now talk about Jesus and we'll get happier. But I'm excited about this passage because I think it shows a part of Jesus that we don't see often. And in fact, I think you really have to study this for a while to find what we're going to see today. But before I do that, do you guys know life hacks? Is this a term that you've heard? So can you go to the next slide? Life hacks are simple taking things around your house just to make your life a little easier. It's simple, it's something you don't have to buy. It's a reaction to this consumerism that we're hit with, where you need to buy something for every solution. I think older generations called it common sense, but we need an actual term, so we call it life hacks. So for instance, this one, if you ever have a leaky garbage bag from all the food juices, because you're not composting, shame on you, you just put a newspaper at the bottom and it'll absorb those juices. So now when you take your garbage out, you're not leaking juices all over the house. Can you go to the next one? Here, if you have one of those frustrating doors that always locks when you close it, you can put a rubber band over the latch so it won't seal. No more of this having to put cards in it or whatever else you were doing. A simple rubber band will solve this problem you didn't know you had until you learned about this hack. Go to the next one. I think this is probably my favorite one that I've come across. Whenever you're writing something and you cross it out, you don't want people to know what you just wrote, because everybody, when we see something crossed out, we go see what it was. All you do is you write other letters over the word, and they will never know which letters are with the original word. This is not something I could have figured out until I saw it yesterday when I was looking for this. But it's brilliant, so next time, just write other letters over the word. That's good, you can go to the next. So those are our life hacks for the morning. But Jesus, I think, really understands us. Like, he really understands our nature. And throughout this Sermon on the Mount that I think you guys have been going through, he's giving us life hacks. He's giving us these solutions to make our life more enjoyable, more fulfilling, and more in line with our purpose and with how he's created us. So a few weeks ago, you guys probably looked at a passage where Jesus says in Matthew 5:20, I tell you, unless your righteousness surpasses those of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Did you guys talk about that? I hope you did, but if you didn't, I'm going to give you a little briefer on that because it's very important for all of what Jesus is doing at this section of the Sermon on the Mount. You've probably noticed this pattern where he takes something from the Old Testament. He says, you have heard it said. And he quotes a verse. But I say to you. And he flips it. He does something different to it. What he's really doing is taking an Old Testament law, something that is good. Christians, we don't really think of the Old Testament law as being good and as of being from God. We kind of think that Jesus has surpassed it. But Jesus says, I haven't come to erase the law. I haven't come to even get rid of the little dot that you put above the eye, is really what he says in the Greek, that little dot. I haven't come to get rid of that at all. But I've come to fulfill the law. I've come to bring meaning to the law, to bring to make it perfect and complete. And so now, as he's going through in this Sermon on the Mount, taking these laws, he's showing the people where they missed the heart of the law, where they got caught up on what the law was saying instead of realizing what it was intending, which we love to do, don't we? Our written culture, we love to make our arguments based on what's written down instead of trying to figure out what does God actually want from it. So this, I think this stems from our British understanding of law, because we get our understanding of law from Britain, from common law, and that's where our whole court system's developed. But all of those laws are negative laws. So when I say negative laws, I mean they tell you what you can't do. So you're not going to find a law that says you are allowed to drive without distractions around you. You'll never see that law. You will see a law that says you are not allowed to drive distracted, right? This is how our laws are. There may be a few that break this mold, but those are the few that prove the rule. So this negative law, things that you can't do, we take that when we come to Scripture, when we read Jesus' teachings, when we read the Old Testament. We take it as, this is what I can't do, so I'll figure out something else around it. We kind of use it as a rubric. There's some teachers here, right? Use it as a rubric. It's a checklist. If you're not a teacher, you went to school and you still got graded, right? I don't know what they did. A's, B's, 1's, 2's, star, meteor, something like that. but we kind of look at the law as a rubric. I want to challenge that a little bit. So the Hebrew word for law, that we should never translate law, so if there's anything you take away today, it's stop talking about the law. The word is Torah. You might have heard this before. Maybe if you have Jewish friends, they might have talked about the Torah. But the word Torah means teaching, instruction, guidance, and then law. Ultimately, it's this far greater picture than we like to see it as. We need our boxes. We need to have our structure, so we translate it law. It's partly the Greeks' fault. We can blame them. They didn't have a good enough word to translate Torah, so they had to use their word for law. But in reality, when we read the Old Testament, this is teaching, this is wisdom that can actually enhance our lives, like these life hacks. Well, a lot better than these life hacks can. More like an owner's manual, as opposed to a law. So I want that to be in your mind as we're approach the passage today. This isn't a checklist to say, have I retaliated against somebody? To what extent did I retaliate? That's not what this is about at all. Jesus wants to offer us a better way to live our lives. And I will stand by it by saying your life will be better if you take serious what Jesus is saying here. But also, there's a twist coming, so you can stay tuned for that. I want to read this passage one more time, now that I've talked a little bit about this and primed you. But I want you to listen to it. Instead of reading it on the screen, we're our culture, we don't really listen enough. So listen to the words that I'm saying. If something stands out to you, by the way, hold on to that. That might be the Spirit trying to tell you something. But I'm going to read through these verses again, and then we'll go through it. So starting in verse 38. You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who begs from you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you. This saying, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, have you heard this before? This is a saying that worked its way into our culture because of the Bible. So it would have been one of those New King James sayings that English really latched onto. But ultimately, it actually comes from the Old Testament law. Now, I want you to think to yourself, what does an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth mean to you? So just think about that for a minute. What message does that convey to you? I know the message it conveys to me. It's this sense of retaliation. You hurt me, I get to hurt you. Eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. God gave this law to the Israelites. But he gave this law to cap what the retribution, do you remember? So retribution versus retaliation. He gave this law to say you can only get this much back from somebody if they have wronged you. If they've stolen your ox, there's a cap to what you can do. If they take your farm animal, you cannot go and take their house from them. So quite, instead of inspiring retaliation, this is God saying, I'm going to limit what you're allowed to do to prevent escalation. That was the idea behind it. And maybe the Jews were following that. We don't really know. We can't really see their legal system. But the idea was when somebody has wronged you, do the just thing and go no farther. But that's not often how it comes across in my mind, and I'm sure in the rest of you, when you've heard that saying, it was a little different. But this is how Jesus starts everything he's about to say. So we know that everything he's about that follows relates to this. So his next line, don't resist the one who is evil. What is that? What do you hear when I say that? Don't resist the one who is evil. Once again, I think that when we read this culturally, we get a very different picture. I don't want to speak for you, but what I hear is I'm supposed to stand on the sidelines while somebody is out there committing evil, whether it's against me or against someone else. Don't resist the one who is evil. This is a problem with English translations, just with translation in general, because you never have a perfect word-for-word translation. translation. So if any of you know other languages, you've probably gone through this problem of translating and realizing there's not a word that I can use to actually get across the idea I need. Kathy was in, I didn't tell her I was going to share this, but Kathy was in Honduras recently, and being the only Spanish-speaking person on the trip, she was working like double duty, doing all of their regular stuff, but also translating for everybody else. And she shared with me how exhausting it is to be a translator. So you don't think it would be that much work, but the truth is you have to think in a totally different way and communicate in a totally different way. And that is very fatiguing on your brain. But it's similar right here with this passage. Don't resist the one who is evil. The idea in the Greek, and that we ought to pull from this, is more about targeting the individual. Targeting the individual instead of the evil. When we retaliate, we don't retaliate against the evil action, do we? We retaliate against the person. We don't retaliate against the man who drove through our fence post. Does that ever happen on a farm? Somebody lose control of their truck and they take out your fence post, right? We don't retaliate against that action. We retaliate against the person who was driving the truck, right? Against the one who did the evil. Jesus wants to challenge this. This is going to come more fully in a minute, but to explain this, I need Kathy to come on up. While she's coming up, I'm going to share one more little thing. You can come up. Jesus has set the stage here that has set the stage to say retaliation should be replaced with justice. Eugene Peterson said it really well in The Message when he translated this section. Here's another old saying that deserves a second look. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Is that going to get us anywhere? Here's what I propose. Don't hit back at all. That idea of hitting back is so packed, right, with retaliation language. You hit me, I get to hit you back. I didn't hit first, but I get to hit back. But I love how Peterson phrases it. Is that going to get us anywhere at all? So this is how Jesus has started this. And then he goes on to say, if somebody strikes you on the right cheek, turn to them the left also. What's your culture? What's your understanding of that passage? Somebody hit me, so I guess I have to let them hit me again. It's kind of almost how it comes across. But I need Kathy to help demonstrate this for us. So she has a lot of, like, Kathy and I are planning a wedding right now, so she has a lot of pent-up frustration. So we're going to use it today. Jesus specifically says, I don't know if you've caught this, he specifically says if somebody strikes you on the right cheek, turn to them the other also. Not if they strike you on the cheek, turn to them the other also. Matthew has caught this little nuance in Jesus' teaching and shared it to us. So, Kathy, I want you to smack me on my right cheek, please. Naturally. Oh, okay, well, hold on. She jumped to the end. So, normally, if she wants to slap me on my right cheek, she has to use her left hand, right? That's the only way it works. But in this culture, your left hand is used for dirty things. So you don't interact with your left hand at all, right? I mean, toilet paper, washing your hands, like, that was down the road. So your left hand is a non-hand. So you do everything with your right hand. So Kathy would not have slapped me with her left hand, as you noticed. She would have done, do it again. She would have had to slap me with the back of her right hand. Most cultures have this same understanding of a backhanded slap. It is demeaning. It's coming from a sense of I'm superior to you, so I slap you with the back of my hand. Sometimes it would be a parent, if they were to hit a child, they'll hit with the back of their hand. But it is this very uneven relationship. And that's the point. Kathy, unless you want to hit me again. No. Specifically, backhand. So Jesus is not saying if somebody hits you, just stay in that dangerous situation and be hit again. He's getting at this deeper message. If somebody is demeaning you, if somebody is looking down on you, judging you because of the various isms that we have in our world, the classism, racism, sexism, whatever, if somebody has built this social structure and they think that they are superior to you, and they hit you on the right cheek, turn to them the other also. This also still sounds counterintuitive, but the point is, make them treat you like an equal. Make them hit you with the front of their hand, like they would if you guys were equals. This is a subversive Jesus. This is a different Jesus than the one that we normally hear about. It's probably a different message of turn the other cheek than you've heard recently. Far from being a doormat, far from just keeping yourself in dangerous situations or taking this abuse, Jesus is saying, stand up for yourself and subvert this structure, this social structure that has them thinking they're better than you. Subvert is a word I'm going to use quite a bit. It's on the screen in front of you. Subvert means to overthrow. Specifically used with rebels. Overthrow. The next thing Jesus says is, if somebody takes you to court and sues you for your tunic, is what our translations say, but in reality, this is the closest clothing that you have to your skin. It's your undergarments. If somebody sues you and takes your undergarments, give them your cloak also. Once again, this at first it feels like, Jesus, I have almost nothing, and now you're telling me to give the rest of what I have away? But this is nuanced with legal language also. In the law, if you loaned some money to someone, you need some kind of a pledge back, you need a guarantee. We have a credit system now, but they didn't have a credit score. So you need a guarantee they're going to pay you back so you can give them your coat. Specifically is what the law says. If someone borrows money from you and gives you your coat, their coat, in pledge, you have to return that coat by the end of the day because they have nothing else to sleep with. So the Israelite law had this kind of social justice component built in where you can't oppress somebody who is borrowing from you. You can have your pledge during the day, but at night you give it back to them until they pay the money. It seems in this example, this person has found a way around that because instead of taking your cloak, they're taking your other clothes. Clothes that they don't have to give back because they found a legal loophole. Now, this kind of legal oppression is not uncommon. You guys probably aren't surprised. A lot of us, when we think of lawyers, we think of loopholes like this to try and subvert the law, to get around the law. But this Jesus, his response is, if somebody tries to cheat the law by doing that, give them your cloak. Now, what happens when you have no clothes? Okay, you guys all have the picture. We don't need any more. When you're standing in a courtroom naked, if you're sitting in a courtroom looking at somebody who is naked in front of the judge, what do you think? Do you think that he's crazy, or do you think, I need to look away? We have this sense of our own shame that comes with seeing another person in that position, don't we? And Jesus is saying, if somebody is taking advantage of you legally, show them what they're doing. Show them it's wrong. Stand there naked and hope that they'll get the point. Especially in a Jewish culture. If you remember reading the story, there's a story in the Old Testament where Noah drinks too much and he passes out naked in his tent and his brothers walk in backwards and cover him up. But the third brother actually jokes about it, makes fun of his father for doing this. And that third brother is cursed. Because in this Jewish culture, somebody else's nakedness is a shame to you and you need to avoid it. This is a key thing that we wouldn't have really picked up. So maybe don't practice this like literally in court if somebody does sue you, because it would probably have a different message. You will make the papers, but once again, it's this idea of stand up to the legal oppression that is around you. Don't let it go on. Don't ignore it. Stand up to it. Make sure others can see it. Walk 2 miles with someone. If someone forces you to walk 1 mile, walk with them too. In the crucifixion, do you guys remember Simon of Cyrene? Simon is the man who is forced to carry the cross for Jesus. It's really cool that he's mentioned by name because it probably means he became a Christian through that moment and was able to, he was a member of the community. That's why they called him by name. But Simon was forced to carry the cross for Jesus. This is something that the Romans did everywhere they went. They would have this idea of forced labor. So they could force you to carry a load for a certain distance, 1 mile, in Jesus' story here. They could force you to carry something for 1 mile, but if they forced you to carry it longer than that, there was repercussions for them. There would be punishment for them. Israel lived in this political oppression. The Middle East has always been a hotspot. Right now, there's always conflict. There always has been. It's just one of those places. Maybe it's just really hot there. I don't know. But it's always conflict. So Jesus is saying, when these political oppressors are upon you, when they're forcing you to do labor, in essence, bringing you back to slavery that you had in Egypt, go that extra mile to put the pressure on them so they'll get in trouble if they're found out. This subversive way of overcoming political oppression. This is what Jesus is getting at. Isn't that so different than how you understood this before? Like, march a mile, I'll walk, and then I'll grumble the other second mile just so that I show them I can walk that second mile. No. Fight back against their political oppression. And to the people Jesus is talking to, this is a charged statement. I love how witty and clever Jesus is. And I think when we spend eternity with him, we're going to get this like personality of Jesus that we never could have pictured. But he's very witty. He's very clever. Romans are around him as he's telling the story, right? Soldiers don't ignore a gathering of thousands of people that follow Jesus. So the soldiers are there and they're hearing this, and they can probably understand the message he's saying, but he's not saying it. Subtext, right? This is a lot of Jesus' teaching is contained in the subtext. So walk 2 miles. Fight back against this political oppression. The last thing he says is actually like a total spin. Where does it come from? If somebody asks money for you, give it to them. And if somebody tries to borrow from you, don't turn them away. It almost seems like it doesn't apply at all to these three examples he's given so far. But we know, because he used his little introduction of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and that the next verse is a different Old Testament verse that he's quoting, we know that Jesus means this generosity to be connected to the two. And I find it as an interesting twist. His first three are, if somebody is oppressing you, respond in this way. Subvert that oppression in some way. Don't strike them back. Don't go for the tooth, but fight back in a different way. In this case, he says, if you see somebody else who is being oppressed, help them. If you see somebody who doesn't have any money, remember, they don't have credit cards. They don't have this concept of credit. If you don't have money in this world, it's because you don't have food to eat. It's not because you bought a car you couldn't afford. That's a modern concept. These people, it's because they're poor. It's because the way that their economic system is structured, they cannot advance. They can't get ahead. They're constantly subsistence farmers. If you see someone who is stuck in that situation, give to them. And if they ask for your help, help them. So if you're oppressed, fight back against your oppressors. If you see other people being oppressed, fight back against their oppressors. This is the subtext of the message Jesus is saying. So far from let people walk all over you, let people abuse you, demean you, or whatever ideas we normally get from this, Jesus is saying, take a stand for justice. Our God is a God who loves justice. This is where this idea of the subversive kingdom comes out. Because Jesus did these teachings for us. And remember the life hacks? This idea of a subversive kingdom will improve our lives. It will improve our societies. We actually already get to see some of the benefits because the people who have come before us have fought to build a system that is equal. If not equitable, it's at least equal. We have a court system where it's harder and harder for people to abuse it. We still see it, so we still have work to do on our side, but it's changing. Our politics, we're in a democracy, everyone has a voice. Something completely unheard of in this Roman occupation that Jesus is speaking to. But there is still work to be done, which is why the church is now the subversive kingdom. All of us going out, I want you to like just imagine this with me. Do you guys know Star Wars? Do you want to be the Empire or the Rebels? Which one? If you could choose, which one would you be? Just yell it out. Thank you. Okay, that's the right answer. So nobody else answer the other way. If you could be the Empire or the Rebels, you'd be the Rebels. They're the good guys. They're fighting for the true virtue, right? I want you to picture this. Our kingdom, the kingdom of God, are these little rebels running around, overthrowing evil wherever we see it. John Swinton wrote a book called Raging with Compassion, and in it he says, the church's mission is to resist evil at every turn. That's what Jesus says too. Resist evil wherever you find it. So imagine now, we're all these little rebels, we're sneaking around the world, we're finding evil, we're identifying evil. We have to get into the world to identify the evil, by the way. You can't do this from the outside. You have to be in. You have to know your neighbors, the people that you work with. Get into the social groups. We're identifying evil. And what's our little blaster? Maybe you have a lightsaber. And we're killing the evil. We're dismantling the evil that is around us. This is the message Jesus is really saying. If you see personal oppression, if you see classism, if you see any of this, turn the other cheek. Get rid of that. Make them treat you like another human being. If you see legal oppression, if you see the courts are just abusing certain people because this person can afford to pay for a better lawyer, can stall the legal system. How many of you guys, have you guys heard about the recent gangster in Calgary that was let off because the legal system just took too long? And now this man who's been we have a legal system, innocent until proven guilty. This alleged gang leader is now free to walk the streets after murder, after thievery, after trafficking, after all of the horrible things that have happened. He's now free because our legal system is so backed up. There is work to be done on the legal side. And as the subversive kingdom, Jesus has given this to us. And political oppression. If you see political oppression, just policies that are being created which are just are bad for people. As a subversive kingdom, we need to identify that and to stand up. The church was never meant to be something that just stays in the background and we just go and live our lives and have our faith on the side. Being a part of this subversive kingdom means daily seeking out evil and subverting it, overthrowing it, cheering for the rebels to win the day. When you see people who, because of whatever's going on in their lives, are hurting, need help, the subversive kingdom is there to support, to help. Now, we love to think of doing things solo. Han Solo, the new Star Wars movie coming out. It's a good pun, come on. But we love to do things solo. But Jesus is telling this to the community. Be a subversive community. He's saying to the church in Cremona, go subvert evil wherever it is in your community, together. So as I wrap up this morning, I'm throwing this to you to say, where is the evil? Where is the injustice in Cremona right now? Where is the evil and injustice on the reserves that are just down the street from you guys? Where's the evil and injustice in your neighbors' lives? Remember, do not resist the evil one, but resist the evil. Where's the evil in this congregation? Injustice, evil, they sneak in. It's hard to see. We're often blind to it. Isn't it so good that we have the Holy Spirit for this? To seriously walk with the Spirit in this subversive kingdom, imagine the change that would occur. Imagine the adventure that you'd be on. Living as a rebel isn't easy. And they get blasters shot at them. They're dodging in star fights, whatever's going on. That's not easy, but it's needed. Live in the subversive kingdom. I want to pray for you guys. I think this is a hefty challenge that's been put down. I think it's something that I could preach on for the next couple months, and we would still keep finding things that we need to talk about. but I'm giving this to you now so you can live subversively wherever you are, identify evil, and make change. Come pray with me. Spirit, we have been given this immense task, and we need you. We need you in our daily lives to identify the evil and the oppression that's around us so that we can fight back, and not in a retaliatory way, but in a just way. Spirit, we ask for your inspiration. We ask for your guidance. We ask also for your intervention in whatever way. Give us eyes to see injustice around us. Give us hearts that can respond in a subversive and just-filled way instead of retaliatory and vengeful. God, we thank you for this, but at the same time, we need your help. Please, Jesus. Amen.